Recording. I'm glad I have this little note here. So I want to welcome everyone to the Older Adult Services Affinity Group, and I want to just let you all know that we can use the chat button. We're going to have a speaker. Our co-chair, Christina, wasn't able to come. She's in Russia taking care of her family members, I think. She's caregiving this past 2 weeks, and as we all understand that, we have Adam, the other co-chair. Wave, Adam. He and she have done a great job coordinating this, and we have to give them a lot of credit, so I want to thank you so much publicly, and I want to turn it over to you.
Thanks, Lisa. I don't know if I deserve that much praise, but I'm happy to begin our conversation. And rather than listen to me, I think you'll all be very happy to hear from Beth Salzberg, who's going to talk to us about memory cafes. I'm going to introduce Beth, and then after Beth talks, I hope we can open up the discussion for both questions or responses to Beth's presentation, and also an opportunity for people to share what they are doing for clients that they work with that have dementia. So it's my honor to introduce Beth. She directs the Alzheimer's and related disorders, Alzheimer's and related disorders family support program at Jewish Family and Children's Services in Waltham, Massachusetts. She founded and coordinates the Percolator Memory Cafe Network, a resource for those starting and sustaining memory cafes across Massachusetts. She leads the Dementia Friends Massachusetts public awareness program and is part of the statewide leadership team promoting dementia-friendly community initiatives. She also facilitates the JF and CS Memory Cafe and a support group for adults whose parents live with dementia. She earned her MSW and MBA from the University of Chicago and a certificate in end-of-life care from the Smith College School of Nursing. She also holds an advanced credential in hospice and palliative care social work. So thank you, Beth, very much for beginning our discussion. And with that, I will turn it over to Beth.
Thanks. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me. Memory cafes are my favorite thing to talk about. And so I've got an action-packed kind of 20 minutes, some slides to show you, and hopefully we can discuss whatever aspects of memory cafes or related programs you're curious about or want to know more about. So I know not everybody has video, but I'm wondering if by a show of hands, how many people here run a memory cafe?
I'm okay. Raising my hand, I'm not on a video.
Okay, so there's one hand among the folks on the line. How many have gone to a memory cafe? Okay, I see two more hands go up. How many people have heard of memory cafes? Okay, so I'm seeing most, but not all hands. Okay, so that gives me an idea of where we're starting. So I'm gonna go ahead and share my screen. Let's see, I just learned how to do this.
And press the green button on the bottom.
Do it, yep, share.
There you are.
Okay, can folks see a picture of a coffee cup?
Yes.
Excellent, we are doing batting 1,000 here. So I just, on the cover slide, wanted to acknowledge Susan McFadden in Wisconsin, who is another big memory cafe advocate. Wisconsin and Massachusetts are the two states with the most cafes, and Susan and I work closely together as kind of Jane Appleseeds, I would say, for the memory cafe model. So some of the slides reflect the ideas that she and I have come up with together. Okay, let's see if I can advance my slide. Yay, I can advance my slides, all right. So what I wanna touch on are the key features of the memory cafe model, what it is. And some things that I've learned from our network about what really works in starting and sustaining a cafe, and then some resources if you're interested in starting your own or being involved with a cafe in partnership with another organization. And I'll just mention that the Percolator has a web page. It is listed at the end of these slides. We have a lot of the information that I'm going to cover available in greater detail. We have comprehensive memory cafe toolkits in English and Spanish that guide you through every step of the way. We have a lot of recorded webinars and many other goodies. You can join our mailing list, and we have quarterly meetings over Zoom. So if you would like to delve into this topic more, there's a lot that's available for you. So again, I run the JFNCS Memory Cafe in Greater Boston, and there's a photo of it. And now we have 119 cafes throughout Massachusetts, which you see pictured in that map. So I run the Percolator Network. And one of the interesting things that I have found as the cafes have proliferated is that many people go to multiple cafes through the course of the month. So it really becomes an important type of activity for a lot of individuals and couples and care pairs. So we really try, and this is one of the things the network helps with, to make sure that they're scheduled at times that complement rather than conflict with one another, so that people do have that option to fill their month with these programs if they choose to. So this is the reason that memory cafes exist. This statement, all of our friends disappeared. This is something that I've heard many times from people living with dementia and also from family members. I'm sure that those of you who work with people who are living with dementia, you've heard this as well. And of course, it's heartbreaking, and it has to do with lack of public awareness, fear, stigma, and people just don't know how to stay connected with someone whose cognition has changed, who perhaps has difficulty communicating or interacting the way they used to. So memory cafes are primarily geared toward reducing social isolation. That's their main function. They're not primarily an educational component. Their main goal is not to promote brain health. It's really to connect people socially. Okay. So key ingredients, this happens to be a photo of the first memory cafe in Massachusetts, which started in 2011. And the key ingredients are a welcoming atmosphere, that focus on social connection, that they are designed for care partners and for people living with dementia. They are for, generally, most of them are for people with at any stage of disease progression, with dementia due to any underlying medical condition. This one is key, that no one is asked if they have a diagnosis or what that is. So that they're a very non-clinical kind of a program. And this is important because there is so much stigma about dementia. A lot of people simply will not come to a program if they're going to be asked their diagnosis. And a lot of people haven't been diagnosed, have symptoms, but haven't been diagnosed. It's difficult to get an accurate diagnosis. It can sometimes be a very time-consuming process. And some people have advanced in their dementia to the point where they're really not aware that their thinking has changed. So for all these reasons, no one is asked, are you a person with dementia, and what is your diagnosis? And finally, the cafes are tailored to local interests, language needs. We now have them in four different languages in Massachusetts, and each cafe is unique, and it should look different depending on what the population is that it serves. By the way, I'm just going to kind of keep rolling through this and then at the end open it up, but if anyone has comments or questions along the way, just go ahead and speak up. So to compare cafes to respite or support groups, just to differentiate a little bit, they're different from respite programs in that they are designed for the care partner to participate in also. Most cafes require that anyone who needs personal care assistance bring a care partner with them. But even aside from that, they are meant to be an important experience for the care partner also. They're one of the few kinds of programs where the care pair can be together and have fun together as opposed to just dealing with health needs. Pardon me. And excuse me. They're also a place for the care partner to connect socially with others.
Take a drink. Don't worry. You're doing a great job. Very interesting.
I did a training this morning, so I think I've been projecting so long. I'm kind of okay. So they are supportive, but they're not support groups. They, rather than focusing on the problem of dementia, they're really a place to leave the disease at the door. Again, no one's asked their diagnosis. There's generally no intake process. There's usually a welcome and a name tag with the first name, and that's it. So they, there are kind of support group-like moments that happen informally. You'll find adult children exchanging contact information or spouses kind of gathering at the coffee table and chatting, but the program is not specifically designed in a formal way like a support group would.
Beth, can I ask a question?
Please, yeah.
So you keep saying that there's no, you don't need a diagnosis, nobody's asked their diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that most people that show up are living with dementia, or do you get all sorts of people that might just need some social interaction?
It's a great question. I wondered whether that would happen when I started my cafe. And so the, you know, there's a balance. I think all the cafes have some information on their marketing material to make clear who it's for. We tend to use terms like memory loss, even though that's not so accurate because dementia includes many other symptoms, but that's a phrase that is more acceptable to the general public. So there's certainly information on our Memory Cafe directory webpage and on all the cafe's flyers and other materials that explains what their purpose is. But when people actually come to the cafe, they're not asked. The only cafes that I hear of where sometimes they have people coming who might just, you know, enjoy the refreshments and the activity and not have a particular connection to dementia are the cafes that are run out of senior centers, and they have kind of a crowd that's always there for the day. And there may be people that get curious and come in. And frankly, it's not a bad thing because, there's sometimes people who may not have symptoms now, but in a year or two they might, or it's sort of ambiguous. And we really want everyone to feel like this is an open door and it's not a thing to be ashamed of or scared of. I've worked with senior centers that have just try to create a kind of a pathway for their guests who don't identify as having dementia to become volunteers at the cafe, which essentially means they attend and they're friendly to other people. So that can work. At the cafe that I run, which I've been running now since 2014, there's maybe one or two people who've come in the past who, you know, I wasn't quite sure. But it's been fine. It's not an issue that's come up in our network. Great question.
Thank you.
Yeah. So cafes have been around for a long time, and they came from Holland. Beer Meissen started the first one. He called it an Alzheimer's cafe. In some places they're called Alzheimer's cafe. Other places they're called memory cafe. That circular image is from Memory Cafe UK, and all those little blue dots are memory cafes, so there's so many that you can't even count them. And in the US, they are slowly spreading throughout the country. So a few kind of tips and pearls from our network. So one thing I do is I hold quarterly meetings, and I often will conduct a survey of our network to get information on a particular topic. So these are not scientifically designed surveys, but they provide us with good feedback about operational issues. So some of what I'm going to share with you comes from either the surveys or the discussions that we have on a quarterly basis. So where to hold your cafe? Cafes do best when they're in a kind of a fun community location, something that's not associated with only one segment of the population, but really feels like a comfortable environment that that anyone might go to. So a library, for example. Senior centers are very, very common settings as well. Community centers, house of worship. There are more and more churches and synagogues that have cafes, restaurants, museum, nature center. There's one in an outdoor garden in Massachusetts. There's one in a bowling alley. There are several in arts organizations. I will say the ones that are held at either a day program or a long-term care residence do have a challenge in that those are not always places that the public wants to go if they are not using those services yet themselves. And also, sometimes I've seen a business start a memory cafe really as a marketing tactic, and they want to bring people into their residence and give them a tour and so forth. And people can tell, and they don't like those cafes, and those cafes usually don't last. So inclusion, outreach, and attendance. Cafes as a value really strive to be inclusive. Generally speaking, they're free of charge. They must be in a physically accessible location. And the whole goal is to create a stigma-free environment where people can come and socialize without worrying that symptoms are going to cause embarrassment or discomfort. And they really should be responsive to the different cultures and needs in the neighborhood as much as possible. So I always encourage people to ask what I call the Mr. Rogers question: who are the people in your neighborhood? And then, are they coming to your cafe? And if not, how do you invite them? So sometimes the question comes up whether to serve people with any stage of dementia or just to focus on people with early stage dementia. And here in Massachusetts, all of the cafes have opted to serve people with dementia at any stage. And I've come to believe there are really a lot of advantages to that. It means you don't have to screen people. You don't have to tell them, okay, this is not appropriate anymore. You need to move on. So that's a lot of very difficult and sometimes quite painful management that you don't need to do. Also, unfortunately, people often are coming to cafes not right off the bat when they develop symptoms, but a little later in disease progression. And disease progression can be pretty quick with dementia. So if you're limiting yourself to early stage, you're going to have people potentially for a short time, and you're going to have more of a revolving door, which makes it harder to build that sense of community. So it's really nice to be able to serve people longer. In my experience, you know, the guests who have come to my cafe for the longest, it's been maybe two and a half years. And we do have a lot of people who are with us only 6 months to a year because of disease progression, unfortunately. Either they pass away, or in some cases they need to go to a full-time day program, or they move to a residence, and they're still welcome to come, but sometimes it just becomes difficult for the family member to take them, or they feel that it's upsetting, and it just doesn't happen. So if a program is concerned about serving guests with advanced dementia, again, they can come back to this requirement that each person who needs personal care assistance should bring a care partner. That's really the issue, is you want to make sure you have enough hands on deck. We did a survey a while ago about whether cafes are having difficulties due to dementia symptoms, and there were 56 cafes that responded to the survey, and only a handful of them had ever had a situation where they needed to go beyond sort of normal program management to deal with symptoms due to dementia. And it was interesting that they'd all had more frequent problems with staff or guest facilitators who didn't have enough understanding about dementia than they did with the people with dementia themselves. So all that's to say, experience tells us it works to have people with all stages in the room. So I think it's important to have, to always be thinking about inclusivity, but also it's important to have cafes that are specialized to serve people in many different ways. So Massachusetts has Spanish, Portuguese, and Chinese speaking cafes, There are 9 cafes in our state that receive funding from our state Department of Developmental Services to include people with IDD plus dementia. So these are people who have developed dementia in addition to having an intellectual or developmental disability. And all of our cafes strive for that inclusion, but these are cafes that are really working in partnership with disability services providers in a very intentional way. There are also cafes that are specialized due to interest. So Plymouth England, for example, has a cafe at a soccer, or they call it football stadium. So, you know, that it's good for them to, the cafes to develop based on what people want and need. So outreach and attendance, we've done surveys on this a couple of times. We find the average attendance is 13 people, but that average is misleading because there's a huge range. There are cafes that initially don't get anybody coming, which is very hard. There are cafes that get 45, 50 people. The best referral source is word of mouth. And so this usually takes a good 6 months for that word of mouth to have time to build attendance. The biggest challenges are lack of familiarity with the memory cafe concept and silence around dementia in general. And then there's also the fact that usually there's not very much staff time for outreach. I would say that in Massachusetts and Wisconsin, where we have such a density of memory cafes, these issues are getting easier because there's just more media about these programs. It's just more and more likely year to year that people have sort of heard that these programs exist. So I'll mention a few activities that are typical for cafes. There's a lot of arts-based activity. The arts activities are no fail, and they're very invigorating for care partners as well as people living with dementia at any stage. Anything related to music is a big hit, dancing, drumming, but lots and lots of other things that people do. Here are some tips around activities. It's important not to overschedule so that you can really go with the flow, kind of tune into the mood in the room and spend longer on something if people are enjoying it, or move along if not. It's really important for it to be interactive as opposed to a performance. Again, failure-free. So if you're writing poetry as a group, the goal is not to come up with the most brilliant poem ever to be written, but the goal is to have an enjoyable process that's invigorating for the people in the room. Got to be careful with background music because it can be hard for people to separate the different sounds and be stressful. Every year at my cafe, I have actually our February session, we make cards for our Holocaust survivors program. So a lot of cafes try to have an opportunity for guests to volunteer to do something for others. That's something that often people lose when they live with a chronic illness. They lose the opportunity to do things for others. And that's really good for the soul. I would say that people always have their antenna up, kind of worried about whether they're being infantilized. That's especially comes up with the visual arts, where people might say, you know, I don't want to do what I did in kindergarten. So we always try to anchor the activity in a dignified tradition and bend over backwards to frame it in a really adult way. So if we're going to do collages, we show slides of Matisse first and talk about how he invented the collage and what that was about. And then people kind of relax and then they can roll up their sleeves and just have fun because we all need to do that. If someone is expressive in a way that's loud or uninhibited, which can happen with some types of dementia, it's good to just acknowledge all responses are welcome and just reinforce that it's not a problem. Because oftentimes for that person's care partner, there can be some stress. And once the facilitator just acknowledges, yeah, it's okay, you know, and just bring in whatever that response is to what's happening, then everybody relaxes and it's fine. Each cafe crowd is different, so it's really important to try things and get feedback. I realize I'm charging through a lot here. I've got just a little more, and again, interrupt me if questions come up. So volunteers are great at cafes. Their main job is basically party hosts. That's what I tell them. When someone contacts me curious about volunteering, I say it's like hosting a party. And some people say, oh, I don't want to do that. I want to stuff envelopes. So that isn't the job that everybody wants, but it's a lot of people love it. So volunteers provide those smiling faces in the room and helping hands to just, you know, fill out name tags and do the myriad things that are needed. Volunteers can also bring in different age groups. So you see a photo of Brandeis students. And when I started my I don't know what that sound is. So we have college students at our cafe every month. And volunteers themselves gain a different view of living with dementia. A cafe is very different environment than what they see if they, say, volunteer at a nursing home. They're really seeing that if you've seen one person with dementia, you've seen one person with dementia. We do a feedback survey of volunteers every year, and it's been wonderful to see how they have learned that these folks are people first. They're individuals first, and they've learned skills how to interact with them. So that's really a benefit of volunteers. And volunteers do need some kind of supervision or training, but it can be very minimal. Financial stability. So cafes are cheap to run, usually about $8,000 to $12,000 a year. The biggest cost is the coordinator's time. Some coordinators do it as volunteers. Most are paid staff. A lot of cafes get business sponsorships, which can really be a nice piece also with a broader dementia-friendly community effort. It's very important to have a written sponsor agreement that sets clear boundaries so that a business isn't overstepping that line and making the guests feel that someone is trying to do a hard sell with them. So I just want to end by showing you some resources available to you, and then I'd love to open it up for discussion. So as I mentioned, we have a free memory cafe toolkit in both English and Spanish. We have a video in Spanish on how to create a memory cafe that was done by the first Spanish-speaking memory cafe in Massachusetts. We have a video about the memory cafes that are designed to include people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. We have one on how to create a memory cafe network. I just recently did a TED Talk on memory cafes, so that's there, and much, much more. Here are some more resources. Wisconsin also has a great toolkit. There are, there's a national directory, there are some regional directories, we have a statewide directory, some other websites, and Jutta Luckvig, who brought the first cafe to the United States, has written a book, which you see at the bottom there, and that's available on Amazon.
Wow, it's really impressive.
And there have been a handful of studies, mostly done in other countries, of one cafe location. And I'm really hoping that at some point in the next couple of years, some researchers will take on a bigger multi-site, more rigorous evaluation of the cafe model so that we can really build that evidence base. So feel free to get in touch with me, and I'm happy for my slides to be shared, happy to be a resource. At those percolator meetings, we do have participation from many, many other states. So if this is something you're interested in, you are more than welcome to join us on those quarterly Zoom meetings.
Well, that's really very impressive, this body of research and what you've done just in a couple of years, so many in Massachusetts. It's amazing.
Yeah, but, it really, you know, I think
you
that-
You can stop sharing your screen now so we can all see each other and talk.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do people have to say after hearing what Beth has created? Does it sound like something anyone can do or feels like it's something beneficial in your communities?
It sounds really wonderful, and it's something that we've been thinking about very actively for quite some time. I'm curious to know how often you hold it, and you had also mentioned people in need of care bring caregivers. How often do you find that people bring care partners versus not?
So in answer to your first question, most cafes meet once a month. Some smaller number meet weekly. It really tends to have to do with resources that the organization has. I find that most people do come with someone, but there are, here and there are people with very mild symptoms who come on their own, and there also are some family members who come on their own. For example, there are family members who are long distance from the person with dementia who come because they want to get ideas of fun things to do together. They want to learn some things. And it's an environment that they feel for them is a comfortable way to do that as opposed to going to a training. We also have, and I know several cafes that have this, a bereaved spouse who had come to the cafe with their spouse or partner, and then after that person passed away due to dementia, they keep coming because they really enjoy it and they move into more of a volunteer role. So there's a mix, but most people do come with someone. Some people come with a professional caregiver. Many come with family members. It sort of depends on the time of day. Mine is a daytime cafe. I get a lot of couples. I know some folks who have evening cafes that are easier for adult children to get to with a parent. So it depends. One of the things that I really try to promote and I love to see is when friends come together. So for a while, I had a whole group of women who had a new mother's group together when their kids were little, and they stayed connected through the years. They're all members of the same synagogue, and one of them developed Alzheimer's, and they came to the Memory Cafe together with her. And we always have pairs, friend pairs. So a lot of times people lose a friendship because they just don't know how to spend time together. You know, the things they used to do aren't working anymore. Even carrying on a conversation is difficult, but they can go to a memory cafe together.
Great, thank you.
Sure. Thanks. Does anybody else have other questions for Beth? Thank you very much for the presentation, Beth.
Of course.
There were so many good ideas in that, even if you don't have a cafe, you know, for, you know, what you can.
Absolutely. Yeah, you could definitely take a lot of those ideas for related types of programming.
Beth, will you be able to share your presentation with us later on?
Or at least,
that's great.
I'll tell you all how to do it. And when I give you the instructions, mark them somehow in a folder so that you can always go back to them, because you can, you always are adding things. Whatever you send to me, I'll put up there.
Great.
Okay.
I did have one question for you, Beth. You said that the cost is $8,000 to $12,000 a year, but can you talk a little bit more about what the staffing looks like? How much time a staff person might be devote to this, and how many cafes can one staff person devote? Because we have staff who are already paid, and we're thinking, how would we work this into an existing job? I want to know how much time it might take.
And that's the most typical scenario, is that an organization has existing staff who they assign this to. And there's some detailed information in the Memory Cafe Toolkit. I haven't looked at this for a little while, so I don't want to give you the wrong numbers, but I want to say it's something like 15 to 20 hours a month, including all the time it takes to plan and organize and then actually, you know, get the food and facilitate the cafe on that day of the month. Obviously, if it's a weekly cafe, it's going to be more time than that.
Yeah. Thanks.
Sure.
And further to the question is also what would the ratio usually be, like between staff and volunteers? What did you find would be the best for that?
So for my cafe, I'm the only staff person, and I have somewhere between 5 and 10 volunteers each month. And that's plenty. It's great if you have people who can just help you with setup and cleanup of food.
Yeah.
And I invite a guest artist most months to facilitate something. Sometimes I do it myself, but often I have someone come in. So that's another variable is how you're going to spend that time. You don't have to do that. There are cafes where people just socialize. They don't have set programming, or they might have a special guest a few times a year. So it doesn't have to be one way or the other.
But Beth, it seems like someone has to encourage conversation at these social events. Otherwise, people could just be siloed and sitting on their own. So there has to be people who, you know, engage the participants.
At first, it's really important to have mechanisms in place for that. So I have these, I have a topic of the day, table topics on each table, and they have photos as well as words. So you don't need to be able to read to engage with them. But I have to say, no one uses them. And a fascinating thing happened, because even though we do have fairly frequent turnover, a sort of sense of community evolved at our cafe. So even though there's always new people coming, there's always people that we're losing, it's after about a year, it just felt like it was this group, and people would come in and they'd just start talking. If right. they'd never been before, there would be people to welcome them. And that's really also the role of the volunteers, is to go sit down at a table and make sure everyone has somebody to talk to. So I think once you get it started and you've been running it for a while, you find that people don't need that much help. And there's a hunger that they have. They come with this hunger to do something fun and to be with other people, because for many of them, their lives have become, you know, we go to the doctor, we do the things that we must do, we deal with the supermarket, you know, but we're never in a place that's about fun and that's really adapted to our needs. So I think there's a sense, once people come and they've seen what it's about, there's like an exhalation. I can just be here. And from that place, people enjoy each other's company.
Gotcha.
I do have one other question. Are there other people that have any other questions?
Brenda, did you want to say something to us? Brenda from Philly, are you trying to talk to us?
Hi, I'm an active listener because I'm not involved with the program right now, but I'm learning a lot. So please keep going. Thank you.
I wasn't sure if you were trying to talk.
No, thank you, Lisa. Okay.
How do you handle the, so you do, you know, there will be losses in the groups, but it's not a support group. How do you handle sort of social work issues, psychological issues that may come up naturally if you've built a community and there's losses, but you're not, it's not a support group. And this is probably something that senior centers are grappling with all the time, but how do you support people through things that, you know, as a social worker, you may have the skills to do, but it's not designed as part of the group?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll see if I can give you a brief answer, but I'll also say, we did a percolator survey on this topic not too long ago. And so I have a whole set of slides on the results of that survey, because different cafes are handling it different ways. So if anybody wants more information about that, I'm happy to share those slides. Great. But in general, it seems like cafes are not doing a huge amount with that. They don't kind of have a memorial service at the cafe if someone passes away or departs. It's too frequent for that, but many cafes have some form of acknowledgement. At my cafe, I have a cloth that hangs, like a tapestry, and people can write the initials of someone who is no longer attending and pin it up there. And the way the wording is, it just says remembering those who will always be part of our CAFE community. So it's meant to be inclusive of people who've died or people who can't attend anymore for another reason. There are CAFEs that are really small and where the guests have decided they all want to exchange contact information, and if somebody dies or is in the hospital, they really show up for each other. That's kind of, you know, it's almost self-organization. Some cafes naturally evolve in that direction, whereas others find we don't do something like that in a formal way. I'm trying to think what else I can say. You know, it people cope with it. I think the care partners, at least, you know, they all know my person is living with a life-limiting condition. And I think people are just grateful for the opportunity to connect and support one another. And we also, it's always an open door for the care partner to come back, and some of them do that.
You know, I think this was a really interesting subject. And, you know, the last time we met, people talked a lot about dementia programs. And, you know, when this came to my attention, I thought it would be something that people could potentially do in their own, you know, communities, as long as there's funding to do it, because I think it really can grow and be something really important to these individuals. But I know Deb also had some interesting programs. I don't even know if there's enough time to talk about it, but did you talk about some choir that you have? Was that you who was talking about that?
Well, we have a day program for people living with dementia, and we have a memory club. So that's people in early stage or people who are normally aging normally that are noticing some differences. And we also have a senior service corps, which is a volunteer opportunity. But the choir, we do that as part of our Brown Center as the day program.
So we have. What's the memory club? Is it similar to the memory cafe?
It's not. It's not. So the memory club is more along the lines of a classroom experience where people come in and learn different tips and tricks for improving or maintaining their memory. Okay. It's 4 hours twice a week, and then you can come once a week or twice a week, and it includes different cognitive activities, and they have lunch together, and they also do some like chair exercise. So it's a whole
kind of— Did you create that memory club, or is it like a, you know, something that's that other communities have? Is it your own memory club?
We've been doing it for 18 years. So I can't really say if we created it ourselves, because I wasn't here then. And I do know that other communities do similar types of things. In our community, we do that kind of memory club. We have an Alzheimer's Association that is just down the street. They do some memory cafes. And then we have another program for older adults with JFS, who Reese is here, called Mind University. That's also a different type of cognitive wellness program. Mm. But the choir is part of our day program.
See, I know Israela from Stanford. You guys did like a brain university at one point in time. I remember Mind something. Do I have to unmute you?
I'll do it. I got it.
Okay.
We do have what we refer to as a brain fitness program. Actually, I had gone to Israel, and they were doing this in people's homes, and it seemed like a very good extension to what I do as a home companion program, to actually have a therapist going to people's homes, not unlike physical therapy OT, but this was to play brain games. The individual part never came to be, but we do have a program right now where we go into the JCC, where we have, as part of the senior center there, do a brain fitness program. Here in Stanford, there is a memory cafe. I'm not a part of it. It's run independently by the Connecticut Geriatric Society, I believe, and it's at one of the local churches, and I understand it's for the last time I heard it was going well, but they only meet once a month or so. That's it.
Do other agencies or people have programs for people with dementia that you think are innovative that you would like to just, you know, we have about 10 minutes left to share a little bit about what you're doing locally. We are not doing much here in Seattle because there are other organizations who are doing that work. But are there other things that you have done in your local communities or seen that you find innovative for people with dementia? Yeah, Alex.
So we have a choir for people with dementia and their caregivers. It's run by a board certified music therapist and they meet once a week. The cool thing about it is many of our attendees also come to our support groups. So it's kind of this great way to meet all of these needs. They have a way to do something together and connect socially, and then they have this other side where they can come just talk about issues that are coming up, and we also provide respite for the caregiver program. And then we also do music and memory. So we do it a little differently than most music and memory places do. We don't really do it in senior centers. We do it in the home and use it as a tool to try and help keep people in their homes as long as possible.
So what does that mean? You go in with a musician to a home?
So music and memory. So it's, we go in and we work with the care partner to create a list of all of their favorite songs, their favorite music. And then we take that, we go back to the office and create a little personalized playlist.
Hold on. Create a personalized what?
A personalized playlist for the person with dementia. And then we have gotten a bunch of headphones that are really nice donated to us. We get iPods, old iPods donated, and we just create playlists and bring it back into the home.
And so what happens? They sing the songs that they remember, and that's part
of the... So the music and memory piece is kind of just used as a tool to help keep people calm when they're, you know, in difficult times with bathing or going to the doctor. It's really helpful for that. It also just kind of lights people up. It's another way for them to connect with their caregiver. Music is one of the last things to go. So it really is a helpful tool for a lot of things.
Great. Deb, what were you going to say? I know you were going to say something too.
So one thing that we do that we're really proud of is we developed a dementia-friendly high holiday service for people living with dementia that's been really successful and very engaging for our community.
How does that look? Yeah.
Yeah.
So it is, like Alex said, that has a lot of music. It's mostly music with less of the readings. It's about 45 minutes long. We do a mock breaking of the fast meal afterwards. And we do it on the Sunday between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur.
So you mean you pretend to eat?
Pardon me?
You pretend to eat?
No, we really eat.
I'm kidding. No.
And it's been really successful. I submitted it for the conference. Hopefully, if it's picked up, you guys will all get to hear more about it if you come to the conference. But it's a really great program that I'm happy to share with anybody. I can send you, we made a Machzor that we've updated every year. We have a cantor that runs it. It's been really great. It's one of those things, as any of you who work with people living with dementia knows, where everybody comes alive and you can hear a pin drop. And it's just, there's not a dry eye in the place. It's really very moving.
Do you have any of that information that the network, like, could you give us any of that to put in the resource library, or is it patented or whatever, you know, people do?
I'm happy to share, honestly. So I can send you a copy of the Machzor. I can scan it to you.
That would be so cool.
Yep.
We would love that.
I might wait till after I hear back about the conference.
I'm looking to see where is it?
I sent it in for a program spotlight.
Huh. We'll talk after because I don't even remember seeing it.
Okay.
I hope we got it.
Yeah. I mean, we started it about 5 years. No, it couldn't be 5 years ago. In 17. So 17, 18, 19, we've been doing it for 3 years. I shared it at a leading age conference, and I know that there are people in California doing it, and there are people in Massachusetts doing it, and there's a community in Florida doing it. I'm happy to share it with anybody who wants to do it.
Okay, terrific. Well, I'll follow up with you. Are there any other programs that people are excited about that they'd like to share with us that we can learn from you?
We're going to be starting up a new software that we got from a grant from the Canadian government. It's called It's Never Too Late. Mm-hmm. And it's designed specifically for people who have dementia. So mm-hmm. that's going to be included in, we have what we call a drop-in center, which is for free for people with dementia, and also the day program, which there is a cost and lunch is included in there. And within these programs, we also have therapeutic approaches that includes like art therapists, music therapists. The music therapist also makes playlists for people. So she goes in, she makes playlists for people, and they can go home with that information and they can play the music that they want in their own home. She discovers what they have. We also had recently something that it was a friendly barber. So we brought him in from Ireland, actually. And what he does is he sets up a little area with a jukebox with old music. He sprays around the old smells of the barbershop. He has like the old tools that they use in the barbershop. And he went into our programs and he put like the hot cloths on people, like the old barbershops.
How neat.
And the men were just... They were different people. First of all, they became very calm and relaxed. Their spouses were with them, so the caregivers enjoyed the experience as well. And then what he did was he did the whole works. Like he did the eyebrows and the hair and the nose hairs and everything. Wow. Everyone looked like 15 years younger.
And they That's all, great.
They all loved it. They thought it was such an amazing experience. So we're looking to seeing if he's going to come back, because this guy's from Northern Ireland, and he's thinking of training other people here so that he can grow this kind of barbershop for people with a dementia-friendly barbershop. So that was one of the new innovations. Yeah, and then from there was one person who heard about it, and he said, my daughter is a makeup artist. I'd like to do something similar for the women. So from there, we're growing into something else where we can give something like a dementia-friendly makeover kind of thing. So we're looking into that as well. And I'm very interested in this memory cafe, because we're going to start doing something for the caregivers and the people with dementia. We're starting to do something we're looking to doing it once a month. And it's more based on a dance theme, so that the spouses can come in and dance with their partners and make it a fun environment where, you know, it's not, we find that when people dance and they move, it's like the dementia kind of like goes away. It's like their memories come back from before, and there's like a different kind of a connection that they have versus just being caregiver and, you know, a person who has a dementia. So that we're looking at, that's going to be happening, I think, in the next month or so as well.
Wow.
So, yeah, there's a lot of things that are happening. And a lot of it is because we did receive a lot of money from an application through the Canadian government. The Canadian government is very much focused on providing services for people with dementia now. So,
Heather and Bryn, did you get any of that money in Winnipeg?
No, you can apply for it. It's a FAC grant. It's,
yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Did you get any of that money?
Unfortunately not. Oh. No.
Well, if there's still some out there.
There is still some out there. There is. It's
Wait, is there really?
Yeah, there's
so
there's
you two
still
should connect after this call.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, so if I have your emails, put your email in the Brenda.
Yeah.
Put your email in the chat so that Heather and Bryn can get it.
Sure.
So is there anyone else that has anything they want to talk about? Anne or Chandra or Faith or Carly or whoever's in 937?
I can share one other thing that we do.
Okay.
we just recently started doing a caregiver day off. So it's something that we do twice a year, and it's on a Sunday. We do it from 10 to 3, where we do, it's a whole day for a caregiver. We try to get them to let us do everything for them. So we offer chair massage. Last time we did it, we did like terrariums. We did yoga. We provided lunch. We did some, you know, care partner tools for people to take away. And we also provided respite for the person living with dementia. So it's really a whole day, 5 hours, where they don't have to do anything except relax and take care of themselves. That's also been really well received by
the We're going to have a folder in the resource library called JFS Detroit Dementia Programs. You have so many, which is great. I know we have to leave. Risa, you'd want to say something? We can't hear you.
No.
Oh, there we go. Okay. So, anyone else? Chandra, Carly, Faith?
Nope, I'm good.
Okay. Let me, before we end, I just want to make sure. Ann, did you want to say anything, Cincinnati?
We're good.
You're good. Who's calling us from 937? Who's on the call? I just want to know.
That's Tara.
Oh, that's Tara. Okay.
Yeah, we had server issues. We got knocked out. Our internet was down. Then phone issues. So we've been off and on.
Anything going on in Dayton that you want to tell us about?
No, we're just really excited about exploring this further and then pulling up the slides and the recordings so we can see what we missed.
Terrific. Well, it was, I don't know, maybe Adam wants to end, but I thought this was terrific. But maybe you should end because you're our chair.
Well, thank you very much, Beth. And thanks for the people who shared, Deb, Alex, and Brenda, about what's going on in your own cities. Hopefully this is only our second conversation. I think what we're looking at possibly for the next conversation is looking at fee-for-service models. And we are interested in someone who might want to lead off the discussion, who has a very successful fee-for-service program.
Or somewhat successful.
Or somewhat successful. Because many of us have tried profit centers in this work and have not been very profitable. So would love to, I think that will probably be our topic, but we'll be looking at other topics down the road, technology. We talked a little bit about caregivers today and other things. So if there are topics that you really want to bring to the group, please also reach out to me or Lisa or Christina, and we can make sure those get to the top of the list. But thank you very much for all participating, and I look forward to seeing you all in a couple months.
Thank you.
Send me all the information that everyone can put in the resource library.
Great.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.